From NPR News, you're listening to Weekends on All Things Considered, a podcast that gathers the weekend's very best stories and features from All Things Considered. I'm Laura Sullivan, in for Guy Raz. This episode, the soggy aftermath of Hurricane Irene.
We went out in the middle of Atlantic Avenue, and it was just this huge wind tunnel and just no one around. It was really eerie.
Libya's uprising raises the question, when does a rebellion become a revolution? And Steve Jobs, a titan of innovation.
Who was wandering around clamoring for a personal computer in their pocket? But little did we know that's what we wanted.
Plus, was that NASCAR or the Tour de France? How a controversial new racing method has NASCAR drivers racing in pairs and upending the sport. Also, director John Madden branches out into thrillers with The Debt. And we talk to a rockabilly Irish singer, Imelda May.
Actually, I was told by a few people, cut the rockabilly bit out and you'll do fine. So I decided to hell with them anyway.
That's on this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. This morning, a little before 7 o'clock, Todd Clissold walked into the bar and sandwich shop he runs in Manteo, North Carolina. The first thing he noticed
was just the pungent, nasty smell that hits you when you first come in, and that's the first sign things weren't very good.
Todd's place is called Poor Richard's, been there since 1984.
I purchased it from Richard in 1998.
That's right.
The original Richard.
But this morning, that smell...
So I don't mean to sound gross, but almost like a septic smell. It's like a sludge, just swampy, nasty smell.
Like a lot of businesses in downtown Manteo, Todd's place was completely flooded by Hurricane Irene, and he's no stranger to this sort of thing.
No, I'm not. I've seen the water come up during the storm of the century back in 93, I think, and the water came up higher than I thought it would ever come because they call that the 100-year storm. But in Manteo, I think we just beat the 100-year storm yesterday.
Our cover story today, after the storm, the East Coast recovers. The Libyan rebels' takeover of Tripoli is a landmark of the movement known as the Arab Spring. But is it a revolution? James DeFronzo, who wrote the book Revolutions and Revolutionary Movements, thinks it's still too early to tell.
You have to have some great structural institutional change for an uprising to eventually be legitimately called a revolution in terms of its outcomes.
DeFronzo thinks Libya may get there, but Shadi Hamid, director of research at the Brookings Doha Center, thinks it's more than that. He says Libya is in fact the first true Arab revolution, more so than Tunisia or even Egypt, because in Libya, every element of the previous regime is collapsing.
What's different about Libya is here for the first time, it will actually be the rebels and revolutionaries who will govern their new country in the post-Qaddafi era, and they're operating with a blank slate. They don't have to worry about the old regime structures. They can really start anew. I think there really is the potential here for something quite promising.
Because in Egypt, we see the military is still largely in control, the same military that was in control before the revolution.
Precisely. I mean, we have to remember that the Egyptian military was the backbone of the Mubarak regime for three decades, and that's the same institution that is now governing Egypt.
In some ways, that could be almost a disadvantage as well. I mean, not having that backbone comes with its own problems, it seems like.
Yes, it means that there is a lot at stake in Libya, that the country can go in any number of totally different directions depending on who's in charge. So really, it's building something from nothing. So I think there's a very big upside, but there's also potentially a very big downside.
Will it be hard for the Arab world to embrace Libya as a true revolution, given how much military support the Libyans received from the U.S., from NATO, from the West?
First of all, it was the Libyans themselves who requested international support. It wasn't as if this was a Western imposition. But also, they did this themselves. There were no boots on the ground. They fought this themselves. And it's really remarkable if you look at what the rebel council was able to do just in the span of 6 months. So I think that they should be given credit for doing this largely on their own with some external help. And I think the fact of the matter here is that sometimes when you're facing incredible levels of repression, you need external forces to help tip the balance one way or the other. That's the unfortunate reality. I'm sure, ideally, all of us would have liked the Libyans to do this totally on their own, but we don't live in that ideal world.
What do you think is the biggest lesson for Libya and the rebels that they should take away from Egypt?
Liberals and Islamists were very much unified when they were fighting against Mubarak in February because they had a common enemy. But ever since then, you've seen different groups and political parties getting further and further apart. They have different visions for their countries. But I think that's really hindered the success of Egypt's transition thus far because people are at each other's throats. So I think going forward, the Libyans really have to focus on building political consensus among all the different factions and political parties. They were able to come together because they all hated Gaddafi. But now that Gaddafi's gone, they might very well turn against each other. So the focus from the very get-go has to be, how do you make sure everyone has a seat at the table and everyone's views about the future of Libya are respected? Because the danger is if you have one group that feels like it's being pushed out, they may be tempted to keep their arms and to cause trouble. So it's very important to give people incentives to be part of the political and democratic process so they feel that they can express their grievances peacefully.
That's Shadi Hamid, Director of Research at the Brookings Doha Center. He's been speaking with me from Qatar. Shadi, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
To the news that rocked the technology world this week. Steve Jobs stepped down as CEO of Apple after running the company for nearly 25 years. The very first Macintosh, the latest iPad, he's changed the way millions of people live their lives. All of this got us wondering how Steve Jobs stacks up against the other technological titans of American history. So we got in touch with Mark Ruther. He's the chief curator at the museum dedicated to Henry Ford outside Detroit. The museum's actually a shrine to all sorts of American innovation. It includes Thomas Edison's laboratory complex and the Wright brothers' original bike shop. Mark Ruther joins us fittingly by iPhone, a product that took off the minute Steve Jobs introduced it.
The effect of the iPhone, even in its just at the few years it's been available, has been immense. I mean, it's very different, for instance, than, if you think back to Thomas Edison and think to the demonstration of the electrical system that he put on in late 1879, mm-hmm. It was actually decades before, middle-class homes actually had wiring in them as built, So that's a great example of a quite well-refined innovation that it took a long time to really gain any adhesion.
So, Edison was clearly an inventor, but that's in some ways is that a little bit different than what Ford and Steve Jobs did as more innovators?
That's a good question. There's definitely a difference. Now,
right.
I mean, if we can think of a typical inventor, we could imagine someone eager to create a device but who then didn't necessarily have any plan for taking it any further. Edison was adamant that anything he invested his time in actually had some possibility in the marketplace, and he was acutely aware of how ensnared you could become in unproducible, over-complex devices. So he's both. With Steve Jobs, again, it's a mixture. What really, I think, astounds is the understanding of latent needs. That is a common ground with people like Edison and Ford. More so with Edison. No one was banging on the door at Menlo Park requesting electric light. The iPhone. Who was wandering around clamoring for a personal computer in their pocket? But little did we know that's what we wanted. And Steve Jobs and his collaborators, that they had figured that out. You know what? You don't need this. You don't think you need this, but you're going to love it. That is, for me, a signature part of innovation.
Everybody can picture Jobs up there holding court at those giant press conferences where he's unveiling, you know, in his black turtleneck, and unveiling his new product, saying, "And one more thing," and he introduces some.
Exactly. The wardrobe and the manner and the sense of a performance persona, if you will. But done properly, everyone goes along with that. It's part of the deal.
It almost seems like Jobs himself has become part of the Apple brand. Were Ford and Edison like that too?
Oh, in the sort of first decade or so of Model T production, the Model T as a vehicle, Henry Ford as the leader of that company, those were eagerly reported. They were quite well understood, and they were very much intertwined, very much so. And you see with Edison, certainly in the early 20th century, things like phonographs, even if you look at the trademark, it's this stylized signature. There was a sense that these were all products that were very, very close to the names associated with them. They weren't just goods with a brand stamped on them. So I think that follows through to Steve Jobs and Apple as well.
Is there some trait that makes all of these people, Ford, Edison, and even Steve Jobs, the great innovators that they are or have been?
I think it's a combination of things. Tenacity is a huge part of it. A sense of vision, a way of articulating that. The beautiful thing is, you know, you can analyze this to a high degree. You can start partitioning out all manner of behaviors and traits, and it doesn't tell you how to do that. I think that's part of the magic of how we encounter visionaries and leaders of this sort, is that there's this extra element in there that's very hard to pin down.
Mark Ruther is chief curator at the Henry Ford. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
You're more than welcome. It's been a great pleasure.
Now, Henry Ford made a lot of noise with the Model T, but nothing like this. That's the sound of NASCAR's Sprint Cup Series. Tonight's race is at the Bristol Motor Speedway in Tennessee. That's the shortest track on the circuit. But on the longest tracks, in Daytona and Talladega, a dramatic change is underway. NASCAR drivers have begun pairing up on the track. It's called tandem racing, and it's upending a sport that has always prided itself on individuality. Fans and drivers are split. Dale Earnhardt Jr. recently called it foolish, but tandem racing pushed an unknown 20-year-old rookie, Trevor Bayne, across the finish line at Daytona this year, and fans went wild. Here to break down tandem racing for us is Ryan McGee. He covers the circuit for ESPN the magazine, and he joins me now from the NASCAR hotspot of Charlotte, North Carolina. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thank you. I'm actually just maybe 2 miles from the Charlotte Motor Speedway, where most of the race teams are based. So this fits.
It's perfect. It's perfect. So explain to me, just in the most basic terms, exactly how tandem racing works.
Basically, two cars together are faster than one car by itself. Two cars we will see just run away from the pack if it's the correct two cars in the right combination.
And they are bumper to bumper. They are actually touching.
Absolutely bumper to bumper, to the point that they will actually rub the paint off of a front bumper or a rear bumper because they're just bang, 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 bang all the way down the backstretch.
Now, why are they faster together?
I wish I could answer that. And if I could, I would be an engineer for a NASCAR team. But basically, one car punches a hole in the air. The second car tucks in behind that car that is punching the hole in the air, and it pushes that front car through the air. The horsepower actually is coming through the second car, but the dynamic pressure is being blown apart by the nose of the car in front.
There's always been drag behind the cars, and there's always been cars coming up real close to the other ones to try to feed off that drag. But why now has this become so prevalent?
When we go to the two biggest racetracks on the NASCAR schedule, Daytona and Talladega, they are so big and so fast, and the track is banked so steep that they have to put what's called a restrictor plate on top of the engine that caps off the amount of horsepower and the amount of output these engines can have just to keep them from going too fast and simply flying off the racetrack.
Just to slow them down.
Just exactly right. And over the years, particularly over the last 2 years, there's kind of this grand equation that's happened between the restrictor plates, the tracks themselves, and the shapes of the cars that have created these two-car breakaway tandems.
How much faster can these two cars go?
Oh, a lot faster. And it's striking. You know, for years we had different rules and we had different size restrictor plates, and they would create big packs. They would create long trains of 20 cars. Or for a few years we had just smaller trains of 5 or 6 cars. Now we're down to 2. And even more than that, certain cars go faster with other cars. And it may not matter what the car make is. It may not matter what engine's under the hood. It may not matter who the drivers are. For whatever reason, certain cars work better with other cars. And in the case of Trevor Bayne, in the 2011 Daytona 500, he hooked up with Jeff Gordon, one of the greatest champions in the history of the sport. And it was such an unlikely union, a Ford and a Chevy, two rival teams, Roush Fenway and Hendrick Motorsports. And then here's this veteran guy and this kid who literally is just out of high school. And the two of them hooked up and pushed their way to the front of the biggest race of the season.
How did they decide to do that? When did they decide to do that?
Well, for folks that don't know, every racetrack weekend is a pretty thick schedule, and it starts on Friday. And in the case of the Daytona 500, it goes on for a week and a half. There are all these practice sessions. Well, what they're using these practice sessions to do now is figure out who the best dancing partner is. And so in these practice sessions, you see these guys literally with a dance card. Okay, I'm going to try drafting behind Jimmy Johnson. I'm going to try drafting behind Mark Martin. And then when the green drops on the Great American Race, they find their best dancing partner and try to get them to the front.
It kind of goes against sort of the history of NASCAR, which is such an individual sport. Some of these teams are getting together before they even get onto the track.
Yep, absolutely. And it is a totally different mindset. But to me, the beauty of stock car racing, and real NASCAR fans know this, every track is different. Every race has its own personality. Every driver has his own personality as far as how he drives behind the wheel. And this is just a new wrinkle. And some guys are good at it, and some guys aren't. There's always one driver at the end of the race who loves it, and that's the one who's in victory lane. And the other 42 are always going to find a way to complain about it.
That's Ryan McGee. He's a senior writer for ESPN, the magazine. And he joined us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks so much.
Absolutely, anytime.
We take a leap now from the real to the fictional, but we're still staying at the Charlotte Motor Speedway.
A mauve dusk was yielding to thunderheads mounding like enormous eggplants. The evening was electric with the feel of an impending storm. The speedway was another Hatter's Tea Party of noise and turmoil. The sweaty, buggy air reeked of hot rubber, exhaust, sun-baked flesh, and fried food. Amplified announcements barely carried over the ear-splitting whine of engines screaming around a mile and a half of asphalt.
That's author and forensic anthropologist Kathy Reichs reading from her latest Temperance Brennan mystery, Flash and Bones. You might be familiar with Temperance Brennan. Her adventures form the basis of the Fox TV series Bones. Brennan's latest case kicks off with the grisly discovery, a body stuffed in a drum full of asphalt, tossed into a landfill by the racetrack just as the biggest racing event of the year is about to start. And Kathy Reichs is with us now in our New York Bureau to talk about her creation. Thanks so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So you live in Charlotte.
I do.
A very big racing town. Can't really get away from NASCAR in Charlotte. And normally I would ask you something like, you know, why set your book at a racetrack? But actually what I want to ask you is, why did it take you so long?
Well, that's what my friends kept saying. I have some friends that are big fans and follow friends of the drivers and follow all the races. And every time I start a new book, they say, put it in, you know, put it in NASCAR. So they finally wore me down. And I'm glad. It was fun.
You say that you prefer to send Temperance to places that you're familiar with. But you weren't that familiar with NASCAR. What was that like?
I wasn't. I'm familiar with Charlotte, obviously. But I had to do a lot of research. So I contacted all of these people I know. I had contacted drivers and crew chiefs and owners and peppered them all with questions.
And you got a tour of the racetrack. You went and...
I did. I got a tour of the racetrack from Marcus Smith, who runs the Charlotte Motor Speedway. And I think the whole time he was trying to show me all the wonders of the track, I'm looking at this landfill next door saying, wait a minute, tell me about this dump, because I'm thinking this is a great place to put a body.
A body.
Yes.
And that's where the body ended up.
Exactly.
The book. What about Bones, the show Bones, which is based on your books, and CSI? You know, do you feel like there's so much
criminal science that goes on in these cases, that, and that's how they're solved, you know, is by some of this criminal. Does it give people a misleading idea of how a lot of these murders really are solved?
Yeah, not just murders. It's called the CSI effect. I just addressed the American Bar Association on this topic. The idea that jurors have way, way too high an expectation of science, that you're going to find that one scrap of skin in an acre of corn or something, and that's going to crack the case. And not only that, but I think there's also the CSI effects, if we want to call it that, impacts. I was just involved in the Casey Anthony case. And I think that also involves attorneys as well as expert witnesses in that expecting too much of science and pushing science way too far to the margins of where they should be presenting it in court.
What were you doing with the Casey Anthony case?
Well, I was the official forensic anthropologist on the defense team. I was reluctant initially, but I watched some of the media develop, and I was offended by how some of the media convicted this woman prior to her day in court, and that's not how our system is supposed to work. You're supposed to be convicted in court in front of a jury of your peers. So I did agree to I did a full examination of the skeleton and visited the scene where the body was discovered.
When you're looking as a forensic anthropologist, when you go examine bones of something, what are you looking for? What exactly do you do?
When I'm brought into a case, usually at the request of a pathologist, and that's because the body's compromised. It's burned, mutilated, mummified, decomposed, dismembered, or it's just bones. For some reason, they need the forensic anthropology consult. It can vary what they want. It could be a question of ID. Who is it? If we have a completely unknown, I'll give them the age, the race, the sex, the height, any physical characteristics I can, so that the investigating officer can then match that profile against missing persons reports. Then we have a name. Then you can go out and get DNA or dental records or whatever, but you can't use those in a vacuum.
Did you get a lot of the details from this book and from most of your books from your actual work as an anthropologist?
Yes, I take ideas for my stories from either cases I've done or cases I've witnessed coming through our lab or our autopsy room, or maybe talking to colleagues attending professional meetings.
Did any of the storylines in Flesh and Bones come from real cases?
Well, we have done bodies in barrels in cement. Never done asphalt, but I figured, you know, I could figure that out. So,
and there was a lot in the book about how the body would decompose or not decompose because of the asphalt. And you had the hand was sticking up out of the
yes.
asphalt, so you could tell it was a body. Did you have to do a lot of research to figure
well,
out?
Well, actually, I saw cases of bodies in cement, and asphalt works pretty much the same. It's a pretty good sealant. It keeps you in there.
It's just like the character in this book was
exactly.
pretty much in the same solid state that he started in.
He or she.
He or she.
No spoilers.
That's right. That's right. Author and forensic anthropologist Kathy Reichs. Her latest book is Flesh and Bones. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Yeah, thank you.
Online, a good review can make a hotel trendy, and a bad one can put a plumber out of a job. It's no wonder that a few businesses are trying to fake us out. And it can be tough for a human to tell a real review from one dreamed up by someone paid to write it. But Jeff Hancock says he's got a computer program that can. He's a researcher at Cornell University who studies deception, and his team came up with software to unmask fake online reviews.
It gets at the very basic idea of what these reviews are about, trust. And as long as there's not so many deceptive reviews, we can continue to use them. But once deception gets too high, it becomes an unusable system.
So to develop the software that you did, you essentially trained it on a pool of truthful reviews from online and fake reviews written for the study. And then it went head-to-head against human judges. How did the humans do?
The humans didn't do very well, and this is consistent with about 40 years of psychological research on deception detection. Our humans got, at best, up to around 60% trying to decide between the two. The computer, on the other hand, could get up to 90% accuracy.
Why are we so bad at figuring out when people are lying to us?
Because we've been lying for as long as we've been talking. And that's about 60,000 years, so we have lots of practice.
So you've brought along a couple of the hotel reviews you used in the research, the same ones, one fake and one authentic.
That's right.
Can we hear those? And let's see if we can figure it out.
My husband and I stayed at the James Chicago Hotel for our anniversary. This place is fantastic. We knew as soon as we arrived that we made the right choice. The area of the hotel is great. Since I love to shop, I couldn't ask for more. We will definitely be back to Chicago, and we will for sure be back to the James Chicago.
Okay, so let's hear the second one.
I've stayed at many hotels, traveling for both business and pleasure, and I can honestly say that the James is tops. The location is perfect, within walking distance to all the great sites and restaurants. Highly recommend to both business travelers and couples.
Oh, wow. The first one kind of bugs me because it keeps using the name of the hotel, which, you know, I don't know if most people would do that. But the second one sounds like such an ad. I mean, there was something about it that just sounds so phony.
So you're going to go with the second one as fake?
You know, I don't know. I'm going to go with the first.
You're correct.
Really? You're kidding.
You did it.
Now, was it about both of those?
Well, I'll give you one reason. There's a kind of word called a function word. That's the thes and ahs, the prepositions, the pronouns, all the little words. We as humans, we completely ignore those. We don't pay attention to them. We don't think about them when we're producing them.
Really?
And that's one of the things. Yeah, that's one of the things we found in this study is that the fake review writers overused first-person reference. And you can hear in that ad that there's, or in that review, that there are quite a few references to herself in there. My family, I love shopping, it's perfect for me, I will be back.
So the second one talked generally, but he didn't mention himself.
Yeah.
That's often...
He didn't mention himself as much, but what he did do is something quite different. And one of the things that is difficult for liars to do is to produce spatial information. You heard in that review, he was talking about location to shopping,
those
sort of things.
You've done a lot of research about deception on the internet. Do people lie differently online than they have historically offline to each other?
I don't think psychologically lying has changed that much. So we see that in online dating, for example, people will lie about their height and weight. Mm. And this is not new to the internet. Men and women have been lying about those sort of things for millennia. What's new, though, is in the past, I would fake my height or weight through, say, clothing. Now, online, it's much more of a tell-me world rather than a show-me world.
Jeff Hancock is an associate professor of communication at Cornell University. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. It was a pleasure.
John Madden made his name as a movie director with the quirky literary history of Shakespeare in Love and the mathematical intrigue of Proof. But his latest, The Debt, is a very different kind of film, an intense thriller about a group of young Israeli Mossad agents in the 1960s whose mission is to track down and capture a Nazi war criminal.
We'll show the world what he did.
You're trembling. I think you're the one that is afraid, David. Afraid of the monster?
The Debt opens this week, and director John Madden is with me here in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The Debt is a remake of an Israeli film from 2007. What drew you to it?
It's a fantastically compelling story, a really, really powerful thriller, but it's also got an incredibly complex drama at its core. That gives you a lot to think about after you've finally relaxed, because it's a movie that keeps you very, very tense, I think.
Definitely on the edge. Mm-hmm. A lot of the questions that this film raised were about morality, and there's one scene in particular where Helen Mirren's character, Rachel Singer, is talking to her husband, ex-husband, Stefan, mm-hmm. played by Tom Wilkinson, about their past.
I knew this would happen. I knew we'd be punished. I knew we'd have to pay.
I thought I'd been punished already.
This all sort of harkens back to the idea of the debt. Is the title purposely vague?
Hopefully a good title expands in meaning as a film unfolds. In Israel, the debt has a much more specific resonance having to do with the debt the nation owes to the 6 million dead, and therefore that idea is probably first and foremost what the title evokes, but it has more meanings and other meanings as the film unfolds.
It seems like there are a lot of debts throughout the movie.
There are, and there was different discussions over time about whether that word was too much of a negative indicator for, for people's signifier, I guess is the word, and that they would swerve away from anything that connoted something they were trying to forget in their own lives.
I mean, you're talking about right now, especially with the national debt or the trade debt.
Indeed, indeed. No, if you Googled it, you had to wade through page after page after page of articles that nobody wanted to read or even think about. And I always took the position that if somebody came up with a better title, I would be more than happy to embrace it. And it was sent to, you know, there are organizations that specialize in this, and I cannot begin to tell you how
there are companies,
bizarre some of them were.
That specialize in creating, yeah. That's their job, to create a movie title.
Yeah. I mean, I remember one title they came up with, which I think was their highly recommended. They offered about 50 possibilities, 20 likelies, 10 that they really felt they could support, and one that they thought was the absolute slam dunk, and that title was Divulgence.
Divulgence.
Which it starts to sound like it's not even a word when you say it to yourself several times. Certainly not a word that trips off the tongue. So
yeah,
I said, I think The Debt is a better title than that.
You have to cover the characters and their older life and their younger life. And you didn't use the same actors and either dress them up old or dress them up young. You did six different actors.
Yes, two sets of actors. That's true. So each character is played by a pair of actors. And the film is unusual in that respect because it concerns people looking back and reevaluating their younger selves, trying to understand what happened at that time and how it has made them into the people they've now become.
Do you have to cast specifically somebody who kind of looks like a younger Helen Mirren and somebody who looks like an older Sam Worthington?
Well, in the case of the former, I think it was important. And she's the prism through which we experience the story. And I definitely wanted to achieve a kind of symbiosis between the older and the younger actor and cast a then unknown actress of considerable brilliance.
Jessica Chastain is from Tree of Life and The Help.
Yes. But there is a great physical affinity between them.
You've worked in television. You've worked in theater. You've worked in movies. But you started actually on an NPR program called Earplay.
A title I could never quite get my head around, if that's an appropriate metaphor. But yes, Earplay, I remember,
Earplay
was the way it was always announced.
Does that help or hurt?
Making
movies?
It helps enormously. I can't tell you. I'm not just saying that because I'm sitting in a radio studio and talking to somebody who's made their career in front of a microphone. No, it's an extraordinary way to learn how to tell a story, because what do you have? You have sound and silence. You have words and music, and that's about it. And the other thing that I have never forgotten from that is the demands that a radio drama makes on an audience. In other words, it requires the audience's engagement. And, you know, I like films that require you to do a little bit of work.
Yeah.
Because I think an audience enjoys that. I think audiences don't like to be told. And unfortunately, there's an orthodoxy in mainstream movie making that thinks the opposite is true. When we test movies, there's always this infuriating question that they ask on the cards, you know, were you confused by anything? And the studio has a tendency to come back and say, they're really confused by the beginning. And I'm saying, well, of course they are,
they
because
be.
They're beginning to be told a story and they want to figure something out.
The pressure is sort of to create a simple structure then.
Yes, and I think it's based on the notion that, you know, the audience wants to know what it's going to get. Yeah. You know, frankly, the films that find a life and become celebrated are films that don't do that. And I don't understand why that lesson is never learned.
Do you think you'll ever come back to radio?
I'm sure I would. you know, and or television and or stage, all of which I've spent periods of my life in. And yes, you become very nostalgic for certain.
Come back to us. Come back. The door is never closed.
It may be a smaller train set, but it's just as good a one.
That's director John Madden. His new film, The Debt, opens in theaters this week. John, thanks so much for coming.
Thank you very much.
Now, time for music. Keep on taking your medication, like the
The song you're hearing is called Psycho, and it's from Irish singer Imelda May's new album, Mayhem. She discovered rock and roll and blues as a kid. Buddy Holly was her idol. So was Billie Holiday. Over the years, she's honed a trademark rockabilly sound. That's right, she's an Irish rockabilly singer. Imelda May joins me now from London, where she is currently on tour. Imelda, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you're on tour right now, but you began touring when you were just 16. What was that like?
Yeah, I don't know if it was touring because it wasn't that far away from home. I would have loved to go on tour, but I began singing in the basement of a pub called Brussels in Dublin. And it was all blues, rockabilly, country, all roots music and some traditional Irish. And that was it. I was smitten.
Were you even old enough to be in that club?
No, absolutely not. They used to sneak me in. But my parents were okay with it because they knew I was crazy about the music. I loved it. Actually, one night that I was there, Ronnie Wood came in and jumped up and played guitar and I got to sing.
Ronnie Wood, that's the Rolling Stones guitarist.
Yeah, and I got to meet him again recently.
Did you tell him?
I said, we met before. And he said, no way. So I was telling him and he remembered.
He remembered.
Yeah, I swore there was no way he could. And then he described the night in the club and he said it was weird, a little kid singing the blues in this little basement in Dublin.
He got me with the hook, those big bass notes, thunder in my chest, stuck in my throat, pulling me down like a rumble in the ground, crawls up from the depths with a deep down sound. Johnny got a boom boom.
Your music, which is a mix of rockabilly and blues, is not what you hear on mainstream, music radio right now. Has it been hard to get a label to get behind you?
Initially, yes. I talked to some record companies. They didn't understand it. They said I need to choose one music or another. And actually, I was told by a few people, cut the rockabilly bit out and you'll do fine. So I decided to hell with them anyway. And I'm going to make my album anyway. And I made the album. And then I was on a TV show called Later with Jules Holland. So then my manager got a call from Universal Records and they said what we didn't get about Imelda May last month or whatever we get now, can we speak? And I said, absolutely.
Not all of your music is rockabilly, and one of those songs is Kentish Town Waltz, which is a little bit different than some of the other tracks on your new album, Mayhem. Let's listen to it now.
Do you remember we traipsed around from pub to pound shop through Kentish Town? Only a five or two were named. The drunk on the doorstep had more to our shame. Living over the offie had its trials.
This is one of my favorite songs on your album. What is this about?
This is just about my life, me and my husband's life in particular. We were madly in love, still are, thank God. And we did have really tough times. The gigs were few and trying to get work, but we made the most of what we had and we stuck together. And my mother taught me well, and I could make a good stew on a fiver that can last 3 days if you keep adding to the pot.
He plays guitar in your band.
He plays guitar. His name is Daryl Hyam, but I was concerned that we were married. Touch wood, it's all been great, and it's brilliant to see the world together, and it's wonderful.
But you're the one for us. My life, my true love I found. Yeah, you, my love I found.
You're featured on a new tribute album for Buddy Holly that's coming out next month. And you sing his song, I'm Looking for Someone to Love. Let's listen to some of that. Is one of your heroes. What was it like singing on a tribute album for him?
Oh, it was absolutely wonderful, wonderful. I was very, very happy to do it. You know, I'm a fan of Buddy Holly's music. I think music has to be purely from your heart. You have to be able to put your heart and soul into it. And Buddy Holly was one of those people, and he was an inventor of music. He was a pioneer of this type of music, and also, a lot of people don't give him enough credit for it. He was a terrific producer. So to be asked to be on such a CD, I did try and get True Love Ways, but that was already taken. I think it's one of the most beautiful love songs ever written. And also I did a recording of Ollie V just for the hell of it. We were having such a great time in there, we just kind of kept recording.
That's Irish singer Imelda May. Her new album, Mayhem, is out now. Imelda May, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you're not here, but baby, I don't care, because I'm looking for someone to love, yeah.
Thanks for listening to this edition of Weekends on All Things Considered. The program is directed by Petra Mayer. It's produced by Phil Harrell with the assistance of Kenya Young, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, Brent Bachman, and Megan Kane. Rick Holter is the senior editor. I'm Laura Sullivan. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays.
I'm looking for someone to love. Well, you're not here, but baby, I don't care.